try and tell a bunch of moms and dads that video games and television shows are making their kids smarter, and you're probably going to get an argument. But my guest, writer Stephen Johnson, says exactly that in his new book, Everything Bad is Good for You. Johnson says that while it's common to hear popular culture has been dumbed down, much of it is more mentally challenging than it was 20 years ago, and that is sharpening our minds. And he says his case is borne out by rising IQ scores. Johnson writes about emerging technology for Discover magazine and contributes to Slate, Wired, and the New York Times magazine. We last spoke to him about his book, Mind Wide Open, Your Brain and the Neuroscience of Everyday Life. In his new book, Johnson says there's a lot adults don't know about modern video games.
For parents who are worried about these games, the first thing I would encourage you to do is to sit down and try and play them with your kids, because what you'll find is that they're extremely difficult. Most of them take an amazing amount of thinking and problem solving and pattern recognition. You have to really focus and engage with what's going on the screen. It's not just about hand-eye coordination. It's not just about shooting things as quickly as you can. And you'll find, actually, when you play these games with your kids that, they are very sophisticated at solving these problems, and you will have a lot more trouble than they will. And I think one of the things that happens is that you start to realize that there's a lot more kind of mental labor going on in these games than we give them credit for. I mean, the basic element of all this that's really worth stressing is that at every moment of every video game that's ever been made, really, you have to make decisions. You have to exercise the part of the mind that makes decisions based on available information. You look at the situation in the game. You think about what's happened over the last 30 minutes, the last hour. You think about patterns that you've recognized in the game. You think about your objectives, the resources you have, your long-term goals, your short-term goals. You synthesize all of that information, and you make a choice. You make a decision about the best strategy going forward. Now, that is I can't think of a more kind of basic definition of what it means to be smart than the ability to make decisions on the fly based on available information and get feedback from the world telling you whether that was the right decision or the wrong one.
I was talking with a parent about this who said, but okay, maybe they get us better at making decisions and thinking about spatial relationships, but is there any real intellectual workout? I mean, are you dealing with things other than kind of how objects interact spatially? Give us an example, maybe from a video game that illustrates.
Absolutely, I mean, let's look at the most popular PC game of all time, The Sims, where you manage a virtual family, you have a household, you have a bunch of different kind of characters whose lives you're kind of controlling in some way, even though the characters kind of have a life of their own, which is part of the magic of the game. And when you're managing that game, basically, you can steer these characters in any direction you want. You can try and build a large family and build a giant house, or make them happy professionally, or make them happy romantically, or throw a giant party for the neighborhood, or do any number of things that you want to do with their lives. But what's happening at that moment in the game is a huge number of, it's what you sometimes might call a multivariable problem, in the sense that there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of kind of variables that are changing over time in the game. So you have the different drives of all the characters. Like, you get to see when one of your characters is hungry or needs sleep or needs to have some social time. You see how those characters are interacting. You can see all their different relationships with all the people in the neighborhood. You can see all their kind of career issues and how much money is coming in and how much money is going out. And you can see their romantic issues and all these different variables. And you're trying to track all of that at the same time. Now, that's, in fact, not really a spatial issue at all. I mean, there is some kind of spatial sense that you have to make of the environment. But mostly you're thinking about all these different kind of issues and emotional needs of all these different characters. You're managing it. You're synthesizing it. You're putting it all together. And you're coming up with a strategy based on your vision of what you want that world to be like. Now, that is a really profound way of thinking. I mean, it's taking place in this kind of cartoon-like universe, but you're actually doing a kind of problem-solving that turns out to be really useful in real life when you apply it to real people as well. So it's not just about, trying to visually remember things or just keep track of images as they fly by on the screen.
You make the point that there's something about video games that engages the way our brains are wired, something about the way the brain responds to mental reward. Explain that.
The idea is basically that there's a system sometimes called the seeking circuitry of the brain, which is related to the neurotransmitter dopamine. And basically, the human brain is wired to in a sense, anticipate reward And when reward, in whatever form it takes, whether it's in the form of money or sex or power or little symbolic rewards of the video game world, when the reward that you're expecting doesn't kind of show up in quite the quantity that you expected, your brain is kind of wired to want to explore your environment, to seek out the reward that kind of didn't show up when it was promised. That's why this is a term that the neuroscientist Jacques Panksepp calls, this is why he calls it a seeking circuitry. You want to explore and find the thing you're missing. So the argument is that a cultural form, this is the argument that I make in the book, a cultural form that involves excessive displays of reward or the promise of reward coupled with exploration will be a very powerful kind of cocktail for the human brain. And in fact, that's exactly what you find in video games. In a sense, video games are always telling you, okay, you can get to the next level and then you'll get this special prize, or you'll be able to build this new building, or you'll, you know, your character will be able to finally fall in love with the character next door if you do the following things. And so many of the games involve moving around a physical space and turning corners and mapping a large kind of terrain. Grand Theft Auto, for instance, is a great example of that. It's a huge city that you have to map. And so I think that that's one of the key factors in why video games are so powerful, and in fact why kids will get pulled into them and be willing to put up with all the work that they have to do mentally to play these games, is because it activates this kind of seeking circuitry in the brain.
My guest is Stephen Johnson. His book is called Everything Bad is Good for You. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Johnson. His new book, Everything Bad is Good for You, makes an argument that today's popular culture is actually making us smarter rather than dumber. Well, Stephen Johnson, surely you're not going to tell us that television programs these days are more mentally engaging than they used to be.
I'm afraid I am. No, I think one of the general points here is that I think that this process of the kind of cognitive workout that I'm talking about is being led by the interactive media. So it's the games and the internet and email and the participatory forms that you really have to make decisions and be engaged in. And what has happened with television is, in a sense, that television has had to play catch up. So while I think the games may be making us smarter, I think it's more fair to say that television is getting smarter. And that's, I believe, partially because the generation that has grown up, you know, playing some of these incredibly complex games, if you sat those kids down in front of, you know, your average, you know, sitcom from the late 70s in front of, you know, Three's Company or something like that, they'd be bored stiff. They've grown up expecting to be challenged mentally by their media, by their entertainment. And so television has had to kind of deliver some of that challenge for the first time, or the first time in, you know, in kind of big pop mass forms. And so what you see on TV is a whole host of shows that are far more complex in terms of the kind of thinking that you have to do to keep track of what's happening on the screen. So everything from The Sopranos to Alias to Lost to 6 Feet Under to 24, all these shows have incredibly complicated narrative structures that if you'd put them on the air 30 years ago, people just would not have known what to make of them.
Give us an example of a show from the 60s or 70s and how it's different from and less mentally challenging than programs today.
Well, one of the things I do in the book is kind of chart the narrative structure, because this is a key part of the kind of thinking that you do when you make sense of stories. When you have a single plot line that involves, you know, a handful of characters following one narrative thread, there's simply kind of less going on. You have to do less cognitive work than in what they sometimes call a multi-threaded narrative, like The Sopranos, where there are multiple plot lines. And so I have these kind of charts in the book that are just a sample of what it looks like, but basically from Dragnet to Starsky and Hutch to Hill Street Blues to The Sopranos. And what you see is basically over that time that you basically have a single narrative thread, and this would be true of, you know, most of the shows in that period. In Dragnet, there's just basically one plot. And Starsky and Hutch, there's, you know, a little joke plot at the beginning where, you know, Starsky gets a funny haircut or something like that, and then, you know, the story breaks out and they have to chase the criminal for the whole episode, and then at the end the joke plot kind of reappears where Hutch gets a haircut or whatever it is. You know, there's some little funny riff that happens. But basically it's, you know, one plot with these two little bookends. And then you get to Hill Street Blues. And Hill Street Blues introduces, in kind of serious drama, this multi-threaded format, and Hill Street Blues would often have, you know, six or seven separate plots, really two or three dominant ones and two or three kind of secondary ones, but it would still have much more going on. Now, here's the interesting thing. Hill Street Blues comes out with this structure. It's the most complicated show on television in 1981. It's also the most critically, you know, well-received show on television. The critics just love it. Everybody says it's the best thing on TV. And it is a complete flop the first year. It is literally too hard for the audiences of the day to understand. There's simply too much going on.
All right, so television has given us The Sopranos and ER and shows that are mentally challenging and have complex plot lines. Television has also given us Survivor and these dumb reality shows. I mean, is that an improvement?
If you're talking about a trend, you have to be fair in making comparisons. So I agree that the reality shows that are popular today are not the best things on television. But to compare them to where we were 30 years ago, you can't compare them to, you know, Mary Tyler Moore or to MASH. You have to compare them to the mediocre shows from 30 years ago. I mean, the reality shows are basically game shows, right? I mean, they're basically, you know, contestants, you know, struggling, competing for prizes. So the question is Survivor, is The Apprentice, you know, more challenging and interesting than, you know, Wheel of Fortune or The Price is Right or Battle of the Network Stars? because that's what was going on equivalently, you know, in the late 70s. And in fact, I would say clearly that The Apprentice and Survivor are better than those shows. In the book, I talk a little bit about why they are, which is that they involve this kind of, you know, psychological gameplay. They do tend to have a lot of characters, Survivor, The Apprentice. There's lots of different relationships. There's kind of a social network that you have to map and keep track of to follow the shows. I think to some extent that's been misinterpreted as me saying, you know, that watching Survivor, you know, boosts your IQ, which I do not believe at all. But it is, I think, why those shows are better than the, you know, the kind of worst shows of yesteryear. So that, you know, even in the kind of middle or bottom of the barrel, the quality is improving.
Your book largely focuses on the mental exercise that popular culture gives us and says that it's making our brains work harder. You don't address in any depth the argument that pop culture is morally inferior, that there's way too much graphic sex and violence and depravity. What is your view of that? I mean, if it's giving us a good mental working out, is it degrading us morally?
Yeah, what I tried to do in the book is to put that question of values and morals aside for the bulk of the book, because frankly, there are 1,000, you know, op-eds about that question in books written every year. We have an existing big debate about the values question and whether, you know, Janet Jackson and the Super Bowl and The Sopranos are leading to this coarsening of the culture and Howard Stern, or whether it's all right. And I felt like that's an important conversation to have, and thankfully we're having that conversation, but it's incomplete unless you talk about the other side, the side of kind of increased cognitive complexity. If your only way of evaluating the impact of culture is purely to look at the values, I think you're missing a huge part of the story. And so I said, listen, with this book, I'm not going to talk about the values. I'm going to focus on this, and other people can talk about the values, and you can decide after you've read my book whether you think, in the end, the increased complexity is is worth the trade-off of maybe more violence or more obscenity or more sex. So I think, you know, sometimes people feel like I'm kind of dodging the issue there, but I'm explicitly saying, look, I'm not going to deal with the issue, and that conversation is already happening out there. The one thing I will say, though, is that, you know, I think, for instance, with the violence question, there have been a lot of, you know, articles and essays and hand-wringing about the issue of violence, and there's no question that the games and the TV shows have gotten more explicitly violent, you know, in terms of the bloodshed and the gore that you see over the last 10 years or so. But there's also no question that during that period we have lived through the single most dramatic drop in violent crime, particularly among young people, in the country's history. So whatever the effects of fictional media violence are on real-world violence, they are by definition, you know, much smaller than all the other social effects that you know, transform or accelerate or diminish violence in the society at large. So I think we tend to exaggerate the impact of media violence on real-world violence, and that's what I think the numbers show from the last 10 years.
Well, Stephen Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Writer Stephen Johnson. His new book is Everything Bad is Good for You. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Roberta Shorrock, and Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.